Past 8, The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackanddrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. If that sound is familiar to you, then chances are you are a fan of Star Trek, the original series. And for those of you not so well acquainted, that is the sound of that famous bridge on which television viewers for years, for decades now, have watched the exploits of Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock and the crew of the USS Enterprise, all created by the amazing Gene Roddenberry. On today's morning show, I am very excited to reconnect with an author by the name of Mark Cushman, who has written extensively on the topic of Star Trek, the original series, and has also written books about a couple of other TV series, including Lost in Space and Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea and I Spy. He wrote three books called These Are the Voyages, which explored painstakingly the three seasons of the original series of Star Trek, episode by episode, helping us understand how each of those episodes took shape, the crafting of the script, the casting of guest stars and so on, how production went, what their ratings were, and so on. There has never been a more careful and detailed exploration of this groundbreaking series. And Mark Cushman is not done. He has now penned three more books in this series, These Are the Voyages. But these three volumes cover the 1970s, the decade right after Star Trek, the original series, was canceled. And these were years of tireless creativity for Gene Roddenberry, also fraught with a lot of frustration as he sought to not only bring other creative projects to the screen, but also to perhaps resurrect Star Trek and bring it to the masses. And the story of all of that is explored in these three volumes. And I'm so excited that Mark Cushman has agreed to reconnect with me, and we're going to be talking on several different occasions about these three new books, all called These Are the Voyages, Gene Roddenberry and Star Trek in the 1970s, published by Jacobs Brown Press. Mark Cushman, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Hey, Greg, how are you doing?
Just fine, and I am really excited to speak with you. I have very much enjoyed these three new books that clearly were a labor of love for you. What we're going to do in this particular conversation is a little bit more of a general overview of this Star Trek phenomenon, and then kind of set the stage for this active decade of the 1970s, when a lot of people might think not a whole lot happened in regards to Star Trek, but in fact there were all kinds of things going on behind the scenes. Maybe we could just start first with what the amount of information that was available to you, and just how fascinating an exploration this turned out to be about these years that the more casual fan might regard as rather dormant and uneventful.
I knew there was enough going on for a book. I never imagined it would be three books. But when I got into the Roddenberry Vault and tunneled in there and started going through all the memos and the scripts that were written and the and so forth, and interviewed all the people that I could find from that period, it was just remarkable. I'll tell you, I was a teenager at that time, and I loved Star Trek, as everybody did that I knew my age. And we all wondered why it wasn't coming back, because it was airing 5 days a week in every city across the country. And the ratings were terrific, and it was, the conventions were coming and getting bigger and bigger, and the merchandising and everything else. And it obviously was so popular. And it was hard to understand why they weren't making new ones. And when they finally did get around to giving us a new Star Trek, it was an animated series in the mid-70s. And then finally in 79, a movie came out, but there were always these rumors that there was going to be a new series or a series of movies and so forth, and it just was so slow coming. So I was asked to do this book by my publisher, because the ones on the original series had done very well, and I went in there and started digging, and I was just shocked to find out the battles that Gene Roddenberry had to fight with the studio to bring the show back, and in what form it would be brought back, and all the different attempts that were made to bring it back, and on. So it was a lot more information than I ever expected to come across. And we wanted to bring it all out to show people what was happening during that period, but also the what it did to Gene, the emotional and mental exhaustion that he went through, and physical exhaustion throughout that decade, and writing so many scripts that never got shot, and fighting with the powers that be, and finally getting this this brought back. So the 1970s represented the rebirth of Star Trek, and now it's gone on to become the most successful franchise in entertainment history. I would assume beyond James Bond, because it spawned so many TV series and all the conventions and everything else, that it, you just can't really think of anything that could counter it and compete with it. But the 1970s was that pivotal period where it was either going to happen or not happen.
Hmm. And, of course, it is quite a struggle. And it seems to me that, I mean, obviously, if someone is as rabid a Star Trek fan as you are or I am, they will just devour this book and every page of its information. But it seems to me that it's an interesting story, even if someone is not particularly interested in Star Trek, because it's such an interesting story about what the world of entertainment was like at that point in time, and how it was not enough to just have wonderful ideas, but you had to have the means to make those ideas, in a sense, come to life, become real. And you couldn't do that without partnerships that were often very tense and uneasy.
Well, that's what we discovered in the first three books set. And it was one book for each season of the original Star Trek, with a chapter on every episode. And these chapters are filled with the memos, as well as all the interviews I did with the people who were involved in the series or in that particular episode and so forth, but the memos particularly. And you see the battles that Gene Roddenberry and his staff were having with NBC over the type of stories they could tell, and then trying to find a way to film these things, trying to find a way to do it on a TV show budget and schedule and so forth. So it was really quite remarkable to see the conflict and the pressure and the demands in making this show, and then in bringing it back, even though they had this guaranteed audience that was getting bigger by the minute throughout the decade, there was just so many obstacles in bringing this back. Because as you said, the books show you the state of mind of the industry, the movie studios, the networks, and so forth, and which really is still the same in many ways, although they have woken up to the fact that there are these giant fan groups that will follow certain properties. In the 70s, they just couldn't believe it. And one of the things that really struck me, besides the memos and seeing the internal conflicts going on with Gene Roddenberry and Paramount Pictures, it was the stars of the show not realizing what they had, not wanting to be typecast, not realizing that Star Trek was going to be part of their lives for the rest of their lives and the rest of their careers. But I loved reading the vintage newspaper coverage of the conventions. And these reporters would go down there and they'd write about these things and say, this is like Beatlemania. We've never seen anything like it since the Beatles. And that's the way so many of them kept describing it. And you have to remember that this is long before Star Wars, long before Comic Cons, long before anything. This pretty much opened the door for all that stuff.
Hmm.
So you get to see it being born. And the newspaper men say it's like Mars has invaded. You know, these people in costumes and colored skin and everything, your green skin, walking around on the streets. And it was such a bizarre thing to them. I guess if it was happening in New Orleans, they wouldn't think anything of it. Mardi Gras with Star Trek. But everywhere else in the country, it was just such a bizarre event for everybody. Commonplace now. Nothing surprises us now, but back then in the 1970s, it was a very unique experience.
Yeah, something brand new. We're speaking with Mark Cushman, and we're talking about his latest three books, which are called These Are the Voyages, Gene Roddenberry, and Star Trek in the 1970s. These follow on the heels of his first three volumes, which focused on Star Trek, the original series, season by season. It's three seasons on NBC between 1966 and 1969, before it was canceled. We should reiterate one of the central premises of those first three books, which is that you try to do away with the myth that Star Trek was canceled because its ratings were so low, because basically nobody watched Star Trek the first go-round when it was on network television. And you've gone back into the Nielsen ratings of the time and revealed to us that is simply not the case, that in fact there were plenty of people watching Star Trek, a significant number, but that there were other issues that made its existence, in a sense, so rocky and then ultimately so short-lived. Just remind our listeners about that.
Well, we licensed the Nielsen ratings for every single episode of the original series when it aired on ABC, and I was stunned to find out that the ratings were far better than we had always been told. Now, they did slip down at the very end when NBC put it in the death slot, Friday nights from 10 to 11, but it was still coming in number two in its time slot, and sometimes number one. The premiere episode, the much-maligned Spock's Brain, won its time slot, beat the two-hour premiere of Y5O, which had a 12-year run, and on ABC was Judd for the Defense, which had just won an Emmy as Best Dramatic Series on Television, and it clobbered them. So even in that third year, it was doing better than we had been led to believe. But during the first season on Thursday nights, it was NBC's top-rated show. Then they moved it to Friday. Not a good night for a show that has a college audience and a teenage audience. Friday nights, they're out. But it was the network's top-rated show on Friday nights, and yet they tried to cancel it until the fans rose up and said, you will not take this from us, and flooded the network with letters and petitions and marched on Rockefeller Center and marched on NBC and Burbank and got the network to cry uncle on the air at the end of a Star Trek episode in March of 68, saying Star Trek will return to NBC next year.
Stop sending us letters.
Yeah, stop sending us letters. They didn't say that, but that's why they did it. And, of course, the next week they received tens of thousands of letters on top of the million that they had received already thanking them. So it was really quite remarkable. But the thing that really killed Star Trek was the relationship between Gene Roddenberry and the network. He was telling stories that were very edgy for that time, hot topic stories that back then in the late 60s, entertainment shows in prime time weren't supposed to talk about Vietnam, racism, God, sexism, you know, all those things, overpopulation. And so these episodes were all going into areas the network wasn't comfortable with. And so they were constantly fighting with Gene. He was fighting with them. And that kind of sets up a sour relationship. Now, if it had been a top 10 show, fine. May have been winning its time period on that a particular night, or even in Ben NBC's strongest show, but it wasn't Bonanza. It wasn't the top show on the network. And so if you're down in the middle somewhere, you got to have a good relationship, and if not, you're going to get axed.
Mm. I I don't know that you would know the answer to this question, but I hope at least in a general way you might give us some answer to it. A typical episode of Star Trek, the original series, I know costs somewhere in the neighborhood of maybe $185,000. It seemed that's right. Roughly what the budget was. That was what was available for them to produce 1 hour of Star Trek, the original series.
Which would translate to about $1.8 million today.
Right.
But that's still on the low end because an hour episode of a network TV show costs over $3 million today. So it's still on the low end, but that's what they paid back then.
Right. Now, back then, was that expensive television? I mean, was that a lot more than it would cost to film an episode of Medical Center or yeah. Bonanza or something like that? I mean, are we talking
Absolutely.
About an expensive series that was something that the networks after a while were just not willing to pay for?
Yeah, the average budget for a network TV show in the mid to late 60s, an hour-long show, was about $145,000. Star Trek was budgeted at $185,000, but quite often went over budget and went up to $190,000 or even $200,000 per episode, especially in the first 2 years. In the third season, they really strangled it, and they got it down, and they cut the budget down to $172,000. And were insistent that it live within its budget, but it was one of the more expensive shows on TV. It and a show called I Spy, which I wrote a book about, as you mentioned, because that filmed around the world. So those were the two most expensive shows. Mission Impossible was up there, but not quite as expensive as those two series. And what's interesting is Lucille Ball was the champion for Star Trek. She owned Desilu Studios. She and Desi Arnaz had divorced by that point, and she had become the president reluctantly. She wanted him to stay on, but he was just weary of doing it after 10 years and having starred in a TV show with her for almost 10 years as well. So she's running the studio, and the studio was built on reruns of I Love Lucy. So she wanted to find a show that could rerun as well and as long as I Love Lucy did, that the studio could own. And Star Trek was brought to her, and she saw something in Star Trek and gave it the green light, even though the board of directors at Desilu kept trying to talk her out of it, even after they made two pilots, and the first one cost over $600,000, the second one cost almost $500,000, and NBC ordered 16 episodes, the first half of the first season. They'd made that many back then. They'd make around 30 per year. And even after they got that order for 16 episodes, the board of directors at Desilu, the old guard, tried to talk her into not doing it. They said, this is going to bankrupt the studio. And sure enough, it did. And halfway into the second season of Star Trek, Lucy had to sell Desilu to Paramount. And there's a picture in the book of her cutting the ribbon between the two studios because they were adjoining studios with a wall between them, and they tore the wall down. And she's heartbroken because that's the last thing she had of her marriage. So she was right. She was dead right that this is a show that could rerun forever. And but unfortunately, the old guard was right that Desilu just didn't have the deep enough pockets to finance a show that expensive.
Right. And while Lucille Ball, for one, had a deep appreciation for how special this show was, it would seem that the powers that be at Paramount did not, or at least there were a whole lot of people in the leadership of Paramount that did not seem to appreciate the potential greatness of this show.
Yeah, and that would be the new Paramount in 1968 and 69, because Paramount had been in financial trouble before that, too. So Gulf and Western Corporation took over Paramount and then had Paramount take over Desilu. And Gulf and Western, you know, is a corporation. And so they brought in the corporate mentality and say, forget about you artists. Forget about you showbiz people. We're going to run this like a business. And that's when, during the third season of Star Trek, the budget was cut, slashed down to about $170,000. And instead of having 6 to 7 days to shoot an episode, they only had 5.5. And then at 6:20 at night, which was right around the time you'd go into overtime, because they'd been on the set, you know, since 7, makeups at 6:30. So at about 6:20 at night, if they were still filming, even if they were in the middle of a scene, in the middle of a line of dialogue, one of the corporate people would be there, and he would turn off the power on the soundstage and kill everything.
Hmm. And that was it. And so it's little wonder that the quality of the show suffered mightily in that third season. And, of course, the ratings sagged a bit as it ended up being moved to that unattractive Friday night spot. And yet the ratings still were not abysmal, but they were poor enough that the network felt comfortable with ultimately then pulling the plug.
The network could get away with getting rid of it. Yeah, because when they tried before, at the end of the first season, even though it was their top-rated Thursday night show, they were saying it was iffy, they may not renew it, and they started getting tons of letters, and science fiction authors were sending in petitions and everything else. So they renewed it, moved it to Fridays. Then they tried to cancel it, and they received this just incredible level of protest that was being covered by the media and everything else. So they embarrassingly renewed the show. But it was a double punch, as you just said, Greg, and you're very right. When they moved it to the death slot, well, that's a terrible, terrible time slot. The kids can't stay up and watch it. And the teenagers and the college kids are out on Friday nights. So who's left home? Grandma, Grandpa, and they're not going to watch Star Trek. They're going to watch Judd for the Defense.
Right.
So it did lose a lot of its audience, but it still was doing reasonable business. And if it was a show that the network liked, where they were getting along with the producer, they probably would have picked it up for a fourth season. But I know from being, I think I was in the sixth or seventh grade back then, and I knew a lot of my friends had stopped watching it the year before. I didn't know a soul, including our teachers, who weren't watching it. And, of course, back then, most families had one TV set. So if the kids were watching, the parents were watching. But during that last season, because of the terrible time slot and because the quality of the show had dipped a little bit, I did know some friends who had stopped watching. They'd go out. You know, they didn't feel they had to be home on a Friday night because Star Trek was on. So the numbers did come down a little bit. But you got to give them credit, because even though the third season wasn't of the caliber of the first two, when you know what was going on, and you certainly find out about it by reading this season three book, they really still gave it 100%.
Well, absolutely.
The show as good as it could be.
It's amazing that there was a show at all when you think about all that was, in a sense, working against it. Well, of course, Star Trek is canceled after that third season. And at that point in time, who owned Star Trek? Who had the rights to it in terms of doing something with it at that point in time? That in and of itself is kind of an interesting and complicated picture.
Yeah, Paramount owned about 70%. So they got to make the decisions. They got to handle the syndication and so forth. Gene Roddenberry owned 25%. William Shatner owned 5%. If you're a minority owner like Shatner, you can't be telling them, you know, how to run the ship. You know, he could tell them how to run the ship when he was the captain, but he can't do it as far as being a 5% owner of the show.
Right.
Roddenberry had a little more say. And he would fight with Paramount over a lot of issues. But in the end, the people who own 70% are going to make the decisions. And they were making a fortune in syndication. And I know what you're alluding to, Greg, because I know you've read, have looked at these three new volumes, is Gene Roddenberry was not getting his royalties. He was not royalties. He was not being paid his profit participation. So here Star Trek is, airing on almost 200 stations across the United States and on in 40-something foreign countries is airing every week, sometimes five nights a week. And through the end of the 70s, Paramount is still saying there's no profit. The show's in the red. That's called creative Hollywood bookkeeping. So there was a very bad relationship between Gene and Paramount. And then as they were trying to remake the show, bring it back and trying to do a movie in the mid-70s, 75 is when they started to try to put that together. Well, first of all, let me just mention really quick, the reason we got the animated series in 73 is because NBC wanted it back. They realized they had made a tragic mistake in canceling Star Trek. They had been looking at the ratings and looking at the demographics and going, you know, this show had the exact audience we wanted to have, impressionable young people who will buy the products we're telling them to buy. And they were trying to get Star Trek back, but Leonard Nimoy was doing Mission Impossible. The cast was all committed to other things, primarily Shatner and Nimoy. And the third year, NBC came and said, can we get it back? Paramount said, well, how would you like an animated version? Because we can get the original cast members to do the voices, even though we can't bring them all together to stand in front of a camera. And we'll get Roddenberry and Dorothy Fontana to shepherd the scripts, get the original writers to come back, and we'll give you a really great adult animated show. And that was Star Trek, the animated series, which won an Emmy.
Right.
But NBC really wanted the hour-long show back in prime time. And then Paramount decided to try to launch a fourth network and keep it for themselves. And they had 16 scripts written, and everybody signed up to be on the show except for Nimoy. And within weeks of pulling the trigger to film it, they decided to take the opening two-hour episode and turn it into Star Trek the Motion Picture instead. But that process went on for a few years.
Right. It's a whole...
trying to find just the right script.
Yep. It's a whole decade's worth of frustration. What I actually really wanted to talk to you about, even before all of that, is that one of the things you mention in the third chapter of this first volume about the 1970s is you're talking about Gene Roddenberry's rather painful divorce that was going on in the wake of the cancellation of Star Trek, and in the middle of him sorting out his own financial affairs and what alimony was going to be and so on. You talk about Paramount in a way that really caught me by surprise. You write that Paramount had little faith in any future prospects for the series. This is in 1969, right after it was canceled. With only 79 episodes, the studio did not believe the series would amount to much in syndication. Paramount was willing to sell its stake in Star Trek to Gene Roddenberry for $100,000. This would have given Roddenberry complete control of the property. Tell us what Gene Roddenberry did with that offer from Paramount.
Well, he had to turn it down because he was going through his divorce. And you know, in California and probably most other states, I mean, it's no fault state as far as divorce is concerned. Whoever is making the money has to share half of his money with his soon-to-be ex, and they base that on what your salary has been the last couple years. Well, he had been producing a TV series, and then suddenly he's not. But he has to pay her based on what he had been making those previous years. So he didn't have the money to buy $100,000. And what's remarkable, and again, this shows how things have changed in the world. I mean, getting $100,000 would be like $1 million. But I think if you just finished producing 3 years of Star Trek on NBC today, and you went into a bank and said, I can own the whole show for $1 million, will you loan it to me? The bank probably would. But not back then. Because here's the thing, there were 79 episodes. And the rule of thumb back then was you needed 100 to have a solid rerun package. They really always wanted to have 5 years on a network. And that's why they said in the opening of Star Trek, the five-year mission. John D.F. Black, the associate producer, came up with that line and for the opening narration. And he told me that, and Gene told me this too, but John was the guy who came up with the line. He said, we were hoping for 5 years on the network. That was our five-year mission. And they were cut short. So they had 79 episodes to put in syndication, and usually if that's the case, you're going to have a year or two at five nights a week, and then it's going to just go away. So Paramount didn't think it had the legs to be worth that much to them. And there's a lot of cost involved in syndicating, too. You have to make a lot of prints and ship them all around the country and everything else, hundreds and hundreds of prints. So they just didn't want to do it. They were ready to just dump it.
And it's just and it's amazing to think of how the 1970s would have unfolded in a completely different way if Gene Roddenberry had the wherewithal, the financial wherewithal, to accept Paramount's offer and buy it back, and if he would have owned it outright, then he could have done anything with Star Trek that he wanted to. And instead, he was a minority partner in his own creative property and was beholden to what the figures at Paramount wanted to do with Star Trek. I mean, it changes everything.
And when you read his memos, it's I don't know if you've made it through volume three of the 1970s books yet, but that's a lot of reading. But my God, my heart was aching for him. Now, I knew Gene, and I interviewed him for these books decades ago and so forth. It took me that long to get around to writing these. But, you know, when you read his memos, and they're hiring writers who've never seen Star Trek to write the movie, the couple that didn't get made, and he's writing 20-page memos to these writers trying to tell them how their script is not Star Trek and trying to be polite about it, and you just ache for him. And for Wrath of Khan, when we get into Wrath of Khan in the third volume there of the 1970s, because right when the first movie came out and it's breaking box office records, Paramount says, let's do another movie, and they start developing the script for Wrath of Khan, and they're shutting Gene out. And he's reading the scripts, and he's trying to say, don't kill Spock in the first 10 minutes of the movie. You can't do this. And he's fighting them every way he can to try to not let that happen. And so the battle continued even then. If he had bought the series from Paramount, all those fights wouldn't have happened, of course.
Absolutely. It would have changed everything. And it's just an interesting phenomenon. It just kind of helps us understand what is sometimes the plight of the artist who, for one whatever reason, does not outright own what they have created. I want to be sure to have you describe the phenomenon of Star Trek going into syndication once NBC has canceled it. Now, this is when I, for one, fell in love with Star Trek. I have only the vaguest recollections of seeing just a snippet or two when it was in its original form, but by 1970, but by 1970, when I was 10 years old, this was airing five afternoons a week in Northeast Iowa, where I grew up, and I became absolutely hooked on Star Trek. I had calendars, and I would write the titles of every episode as it aired, just so it was important to keep track of that. But
you did that too.
Oh, absolutely. Now, explain to our listeners, because now we kind of take this kind of thing for granted, but explain how this was something quite unprecedented, the success of Star Trek in these reruns.
Yeah, you really can't think of another show that did it. I mean, I Love Lucy had done tremendous business in syndicated reruns five days a week, but it was number one on the network too. It wasn't more successful in reruns. It was successful from the get-go. But most shows, you go into stripping, they call it, where they put you on five nights a week if you have enough episodes. And, you know, you got a fraction of the audience that you had when you were on the network, which is okay for the local stations at 6 o'clock at night or 5 in the afternoon, but it wouldn't be okay for the networks. But Star Trek goes into syndication in fall of 69. And it gets picked up instantly by about 70 stations across the country, which is pretty good. It was on about 170 affiliates on NBC. But that's pretty good right out of the gate. Well, each year, it's on more. It went from 70 to 100 to 120 to 150 to 180. And Paramount kept thinking it's going to burn out. It's these episodes are rerunning for the seventh, eighth time in New York and L.A. and Iowa and some of these places. And yet the ratings just kept getting bigger and bigger. And they realized people are watching these episodes for the third, fourth, fifth, sixth time, that they love it that much. So the studio people just never conceived of anything like this. They thought maybe a year or two at best, 79 episodes.
In this chapter you touch on one potential reason why Star Trek was achieving such remarkable success in syndication, beyond just the fact that, you know, this was great science fiction. I mean, it was a great show. But even beyond that, you kind of talk about how a lot of the other shows that would be shown in syndication at that point in time were Westerns, Gunsmoke, Bonanza, Lancer, The Virginian, and that Star Trek was this startling and vivid modern contrast. I mean, in a sense, it was exactly the right show at exactly the right time to grab hold of young viewers across the country.
Right, and you know, you had Voyage to the Bahamas Sea and Lost in Space out there, and The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and The Wild Wild West and things like that. So there were other fun shows in syndication during the early 70s. But if you were under 10, Greg, you probably would have been watching Lost in Space. But since you were 10, 11, going into your early teens, you wanted something a little more nourishing. And Star Trek, with its themes, with the messages and all of its stories, it was just as much fun as the Irwin Allen shows, but it left you thinking. And so when a kid is going into his teen years, he wants something a little more with more intellectual calories than the other shows. And so people were growing up, people were maturing, America was maturing overall as a country, and Star Trek just fit the groove. And you know, it was so important. When you read the first three books, you see with every single episode, Gene Roddenberry was always prompting the writers, what's the theme of this story you're trying to tell? What's the message we want to convey with this particular plot? And it's those themes that would hook into us to where we would want to watch it a second time or a third time or more, because you would pick up more. The first time you're kind of following the plot. The next time you're starting to pick up on the other messages that were coming through in the show.
Right. In other words, you're contrasting this with, for instance, watching reruns of I Dream of Jeannie. And it's not like as you watch that, if someone watches it a third or a fourth or a fifth time, it's not like you're seeing new layers of meaning that were not obvious the first time around. When you watch an episode of that,
less funny. Yeah, you know the jokes, so you're not going to laugh as much. It's very one-dimensional. Where Star Trek, you're getting these deeper moments, but also the excellent acting. Not just the writing, but the acting. And so think of this, Greg. You know, what other show can you think of where you had a character like Mr. Spock who's observing humans and the human nature through the eyes of an alien? I mean, we didn't really have that on any other show. We were able to examine ourselves through his eyes. And where else did you have a character like that that teenagers could relate to? Because to be a teenager, you've got all these conflicts going on inside of you of what you should be, what you should do, what your parents are telling you, what you're feeling, but you don't want to describe to anybody because you think you're the only person feeling that. Well, here's this character on this TV show who's going through inner conflict, two different sides fighting it out inside of him. So it just gave you so much more to work with and think about besides the entertainment element.
We're speaking with Mark Cushman, and we are talking about his three latest books, which are called These Are the Voyages, Gene Roddenberry, and Star Trek in the 1970s. This picks up from where his first three books left off, that is, after the initial network run of Star Trek, the original series, canceled by NBC in 1969, going on to blockbuster success in syndication, in reruns, in the early 1970s. Your book also, this is in the first volume of these three new books, talks about something that we really must explore for a few minutes, and that is the very first Star Trek convention in January of 1972, which was not just the first Star Trek convention, but really the first convention like this that there had ever been. I mean, there weren't I Love Lucy conventions or Dick Van Dyke Show conventions, but somebody put together this thing called a Star Trek convention, and of course the rest is history. Tell our listeners about the key figures who hatched this idea and who managed to create such a success with it.
Well, it was a committee of about 20 people, and they were all fans of the show, except for one person who knew more just about putting together events. Who liked Star Trek, but what didn't live and die by Star Trek. And they all came together and put this event together in New York City, and it pulled in, I think that first one pulled in, what was it, about 3,000 or 4,000 people They were expecting maybe 500. The next one pulled in several thousand. The next one pulled in over 10,000. And then going up and up and up until you got to like 20,000. And going from one or two conventions a year to 12 a year in different cities, and then more than that. And again, I included them in the books. I did a lot of newspaper archive research to get reports from the city, from the floor, from the New York Times and New York Daily News and all these newspapers trying to make sense of this and why it's happening. And they kept using that phrase, Beatlemania, and then later it started calling it for what it was, Star Trek mania. But you're right. Prior to that, there had been some science fiction conventions. You know, they gave out the Hugo Awards, and they would do a convention. And attendance would be several hundred people, you know, 600-700 people. And then suddenly you're bringing in 12, 13, 14, 20,000 people. And these hotels were just overwhelmed. I mean, they just never seen anything like it. Well, now that's Comic-Con. You know, but this is where it was all born. Hmm. And we see it get born. What I do in these books is they're a time machine. You know, we're not looking back. I take you back, and you live through it because we're using the memos. We're using the newspaper articles from the moment, the reviews, everything, and the interviews I do with people who were there. So you're on the floor. And you're experiencing it with them. You're hearing what William Shatner's saying before he goes out on stage at his first convention,
right?
Which was a few conventions in, and there's thousands of people just in that room, and he's looking at it going, this is amazing,
mm-hmm.
You know
the thing that's interesting too. I think it sort of goes without saying, and yet we really have to say it, is that this was 1972. I mean, this is 25 years before most of us have the internet in our homes.
Yeah.
And so just the fact that thousands and thousands of Star Trek fans would hear about this through, mm-hmm. I suppose, word of mouth and maybe advertisements in certain magazines or whatever. But just the fact that this took off so spectacularly at a time when it wasn't easy to make something like this happen the way now. There's, of course, all kinds of means by which you can get the word out in a matter of seconds. But, I mean,
oh, yeah.
I just find it astonishing that this was as successful as it was almost from the start back in the early 1970s. I mean, it's just incredible.
You know what we all went through back then is, you know, I lived up in the San Francisco area, and a store opened up called the Federation Trading Post over in Berkeley. And I'd been hearing about it. And saw a little piece on a local news channel where they were down there interviewing the people, and all they did was sell Star Trek stuff before any Star Trek stuff was really being made. I mean, they had the paperbacks and they had the comic books and whatever, but they had handmade stuff, and this stuff was good. You know, a phaser, I mean, that looked just like a phaser. It was heavy and tangible and everything. And so I wanted to go check it out. So a friend of mine went down there. And my experience in that moment was the same as so many people I interviewed for this book, like Doug Drexler, who was running the Federation Trading Post in New York and so forth, is I was stunned when I pulled up and got out of the car and there was a line going around the block for this place. Because you think you're the only one. I mean, you had no internet, so you just don't know that there are so many people just like you who love this show. And there they are in line, and how much fun it was to stand in line and be talking to people who are passionate about something that you're passionate about that you didn't even know they existed.
Absolutely. I mean, how thrilling would that be to realize that you're part of this community that you didn't even know was out there? I remember that feeling very vividly, although I never knew about these conventions at the time. It's kind of interesting. I remember I would go to Ben Franklin after school every day to buy candy. And if I saw a new Star Trek book by James Blish, who wrote the novelizations of the original series episodes, I would just snap it up. And I remember the day that a paperback appeared on the bookcase there that said Star Trek Lives by Joan Winston. And
right.
I snapped it up without even opening it up. Well, it turned out to be a book about these first conventions. And I actually... I didn't know anything about this, and I actually didn't enjoy. I just kind of tossed the book aside because it wasn't Star Trek Adventures, which is what I figured it would be. And now I just kick myself. I would give anything to have that book back, because now I find this phenomenon so fascinating, and that's why I've enjoyed this book of yours so much, because it, as you said, it, you want to take us back to that time when this phenomenon was just being born, and it's so amazing. It's as though we're there.
Well, of course, I got a copy of the book for my research when I did these books and everything, and the fanzines that were out and so forth. And, you know, I had to review all this stuff. And the book was a little hard to get through because it was written by diehard fans who didn't really know how to structure it to make an engaging read. But having said that, you know, there was a lot of information in there that was useful to me in my research and so forth, and in the fanzines as well, and on and on. So I don't know how captivated you would have been if you had read it from first page to last back then. But what I try to do in my books is make them dramatic. And I don't have to invent anything to do that. It's just my training as a screenwriter. In when you see this story, and I treat Star Trek as flesh and blood. These are a biography on the living entity known as Star Trek. And it's all these people putting all their talent and their energies and their hopes and their dreams into making this show, keeping the show alive, bringing it back from death. And Roddenberry trying to protect it as you would protect a child, and so forth. And so I put it into an emotional context to where you're living out this thing. You're going through it. You're in his room. You're on the convention floor. You're in front of the TV. You're in all those different areas that different people experience Star Trek, but you're experiencing it again as it lived in the original show, as it came back in the 1970s, and trying to put you on that emotional journey, because there is a ton of emotion in there, not just the behind-the-scenes conflicts, but just the emotion of being in the convention room and experiencing it through the eyes of James Doohan and Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner, and like, oh, my God.
Well, right, and it's like they had no idea that they were part of something so important until they looked out at the audience from the stage and realized that there are thousands and thousands and thousands of people across the country for whom this television program is so incredibly important, and of course it's with us to this very day. Well, we will be talking sometime in the near future about the animated series and the attempts to create a follow-up television series, and ultimately Star Trek the Motion Picture, one of the biggest cinema events of the late 1970s that brings this decade to a close, which also included a lot of creative endeavors by Gene Roddenberry not related to Star Trek at all, which are also interesting to explore. Again, these three volumes are called These Are the Voyages, Gene Roddenberry and Star Trek in the 1970s. And most of what we talked about today is found in the first of those three volumes, published by Jacobs Brown Press. The author, Mark Cushman. Mark Cushman, what a great delight to reconnect with you and to talk with you about these endlessly fascinating books. I thank you so much.
Isn't it terrible to talk about something you love?
Such a chore. So anyway, I look forward to us reconnecting again, and thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you, Greg.
Monday on the morning show, we're going to be talking with somebody who lives in Marion, Iowa, which is directly adjacent to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, which was hit by that powerful storm which hit us here in southeastern Wisconsin. Monday will mark exactly 2 weeks, but what we experienced here is nothing like what they experienced in the state of Iowa. It was of unimaginable scale. All kinds of devastation. And we'll get a first-hand account of that from
young man who lives in Cedar Rapids, on Monday's morning show. Tuesday, Dr. Gerald Mast will look back at the Democratic National Convention, what went right, what maybe didn't work so well, and what the Republicans need to accomplish with their upcoming convention. Wednesday will be Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College. Thursday will be Art Sear from Carthage, offering his analysis of various current events. We remind you that the morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock and is available as a podcast. Be sure that you look for the morning.